From coast to coast to coast, you're listening to Terra Informa. Welcome back to Terra Informa. I'm Yvette Thompson, and I'll be your host for the next half hour of environmental news from across Canada and around the world. My co-host today has four legs, is super furry, and loves to chew on bones. We might hear from her later on. Hey, Dash? All right, this week we are chatting about frosty fruit, and we have a great list of what's happening in this vast country we call home. That's all coming up on Terra Informa. Anything to add? All right then, let's dive right in. This week, Terra Informa's Danielle Dolgoy and Hamdi Issawi team up for a very special Dispatches from the Dirt. Gardeners and farmers alike are all limited to the zones they live in. Since the 1960s, Agriculture Canada has been publishing a national map of plant hardiness zones. This helps farmers and gardeners plan their crops to ensure their plantlings can withstand the, at times, extreme temperatures to make it to harvest time. But when it comes to fruit trees, most people consider the temperate zones of the Okanagan Valley in BC or Ontario's southern greenbelt as the quintessential food-producing areas. Most of us don't associate the gateway to the north as a bountiful agricultural area. Despite this perception of Edmonton as a frigidly cold place where we can grow very little, north of the city we actually boast some of the finest soil in the country, classified as number one special. That's where the Evans cherry tree was first documented. And that tree has proliferated over time to become a ubiquitous feature in many people's backyards. Many folks don't even know how delicious those cherries actually are. Danielle set out on a mission to learn more about the Evans cherry, where it came from, and who the mysterious man was actually behind the tree's distribution across Edmonton and throughout North America.
So, Danielle, last week you were telling me about a special cherry that you came across, and it was called the Evans cherry, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So how did you get introduced to the Evans cherry?
So I first learned about the Evans cherry about a year ago. A friend of mine was living at a house in St. Albert, and she had this cherry tree that she didn't really know what it was and didn't really know what to do with it. She's not much of a cook or a baker, and she certainly isn't one to preserve and can a bunch of stuff. So she invited me and my husband over to her place to pick the cherries. And I was stunned. I've never seen cherries like that, of that size and so prolific on a tree like that growing so far north in Edmonton or St. Albert. And so it sort of piqued an interest, and my husband started doing a bit of research and identified it as this Evans cherry, and I'd never heard of it. And so that was what really kind of turned me onto it in the first place and started me on this path of discovery and became something I just had to learn more about and kind of get to the bottom of.
So what about this person that it's named after? Who is the Evans behind Evans cherry?
Who indeed? So the more that I started reading, it became quite apparent that this Evans person had been the single individual responsible for its kind of modern proliferation. So it had kind of fallen off the radar and people weren't aware of it until the 1970s when he proclaimed it as this species that was quite specific to this part of Canada. So once it became clear that Dr. Evans had made agriculture his life's work and that working for Alberta Agriculture specifically, that he had been responsible for identifying the cherry and then its proliferation across the province, it became less about learning more about the cherry itself and more about discovering who Evans was. And when I was able to find, just sort of asking around the people that I knew who were into gardening and sort of backyard farms and that kind of thing, was that Dr. Evans was alive and well and still living on an acreage outside of Spruce Grove.
And how did you actually find him?
Well, that part was a little bit more challenging. There are a lot of Evans in the phone book, but only one with his first initial. And I got brave and just totally cold called this phone number. And to my disappointment, it was not the Dr. Evans that I was looking for. There was no doctor living at that address. So then I kind of went back to the drawing board and thought, okay, you're not going to find him this easily. And maybe just sort of start at the root of things. Haha, the root. And talk to someone who knows about the tree. So that was when I met up with Ken Risky, who's the owner of Mill Creek Nursery. His family had been farming on that land for over a century, and I figured he'd probably know a thing or two about the Evans cherry since they did actually sell them.
So now, as far as I know about Evans cherry tree, it was found by Ian Evans and named after himself. The original tree was found in the Horse Hills area, or northeast Edmonton, and selections were made. People were very impressed with the size of the tree. It can get up to 20 feet in size and width. But you can see they're large. They're up to 4 centimeters, some 3 to 4 centimeters fruits. And they're really an attractive, nice to eat little fruit. When you hold the cherry and pull on the stem, the pit comes out. So you don't need a pitter. Evans was the first one out. It has a very clear skin and a very uncolorful juice. Some people want the color in the juice for jelly, jams, wines, cherry pies, like that. But Evans is very clear. One of the very easy things about these, most fruit trees, in fact, pretty well all of them require a partner, a pollinator. And these are self-fruitful. They don't need a partner. You can plant one in your neighborhood, not worry about another one being present to provide pollen that would enable the tree to have fruit. So it's called being self-fruitful.
So you followed the cherry to Ken, and how did Ken lead you to Evans?
Well, Ken met Dr. Evans at some kind of a speaking engagement that Evans had been at. That was how I was able to track him down. He sort of offhand mentioned that Dr. Evans is a championship lily breeder. And so when I started looking up the Alberta lily growers and all of the work that that society does, it actually had a straight up phone number and address for him. And it kind of fell into my lap at that point.
You actually got a chance to meet him. Mm-hmm. You got to meet the Evans of the Evans cherry.
The Evans. I did indeed.
So what was it like when you finally got to meet him?
Well, after this city girl made one too many wrong turns along the country road, I eventually came to the front gate of Evan's acreage where he lives, and undoubtedly it was quite clear that this was the home of Dr. Evans. There were flowers growing all over the yard, poppies and delphiniums, and obviously tons of lilies. A couple of really adorable sheepdogs that greeted me at the gate. And then shortly after them came Dr. Evans, ambling out of his house toward me.
Ian Evans, I'm in my 70s now. I grew up on a mixed small farm on the Welsh coast in southwest Wales. We grew anything and everything and had everything from cows and horses to hogs or pigs and chickens. And so you developed a pretty broad interest, and we grew most of our own vegetables. And I had ambitions one time of being an MD, then a veterinarian. Then I thought, no, it was better than went into plant pathology or plant diseases and get into agriculture that way. In other words, what could I do in life that would help prevent crop losses or plant diseases, and help farmers and backyard gardeners achieve better yields?
The thing that I found quite interesting about Dr. Evans was how young he actually is. I had it in my mind that he had been sort of a seasoned agriculture expert when he identified the cherry back in the 1970s, but in fact, he must have been still quite green, get it? Green. when he first identified this tree, because he's only retired a few years ago and still really active in the agriculture community and still doing lots of work with flower breeding.
I grow, in fact, my major hobby is growing lilies, and I sell them to the British and the Dutch. They come over here. They've been over here. They make regular trips here to buy lilies off me. All to mention, I'm not a one-trick pony with the Evans cherry, let's say. I've saved a number of apples from the University of Alberta 1960s program. Very good apples. All kinds of exotic plums and things that'll grow here. Royalty crab apple types, the one I picked up in Edmonton. Beautifully dark crab-colored crab apple that is resistant to fire blight. When I first moved into Edmonton, I started looking at things and growing different plants and trees and shrubs. And looking around, and everyone was saying, oh, nothing will grow here, it's too cold, and the apple trees and things that we did grow weren't very good. And I figured the most yards in Edmonton were a spruce tree, a poplar tree, and a birch tree. Well, why not put in fruit trees instead and have a little fun? I worked as a diagnostic pathologist for Alberta Agriculture. So I was consequently, not only I worked with field crops like wheat and barley and canola in particular, that was my main job, but I diagnosed things like diseases on apples, on plums, cherries, fruit, vegetables in the garden. So I did all this, and I got to find out that one friend of mine knew of a cherry tree that had huge crops of cherries. Now, I tried to grow cherries previously, and they never did very well. They just didn't grow here. They were from Minnesota. Despite that, being cold tolerant, they just weren't very good. Then I found this fantastic cherry tree in Sherwood Park that had hundreds of pounds of cherries on the one tree. When I first saw the tree, I thought, oh my God, what is this? You know, and I checked it out. Was it a Meteor or a North Star, two Minnesota varieties? No, it didn't fit that. It was much bigger and much, much heavier bearing. And then I asked the fellow who had the tree in Sherwood Park, where did he get it from? And he said he got it off of Mrs. Bourguard, who, an old lady who lived up on Horse Hill, what is now the federal penitentiary. So when I got there, the land was already requisitioned, and she was moving from that house. And she said, well, I could have all the cherry tree suckers I needed. So I dug up a few of them, and I moved them to a farm site in Tofield. And over the years, checked these trees, and lo and behold, they grow vigorously and phenomenally, and they didn't winter kill at all. And within a few years, these so-called, cherry trees that I couldn't identify initially, started bearing heavy crops of cherries. So by the time I moved back into Edmonton in 1981 in Mill Woods, I planted a fence, well, a hedgerow of these cherry trees all around the property. And within 5 to 6 years, they were bearing huge crops of cherries. And a lot of people say, oh, they won't grow here, they can't grow here. Well, in order to sort of expand the cherry tree growing, I found ways of growing them from root cuttings. And they grow true from root cuttings, by the way. You don't have to graft them. This phenomenal bearing cherry tree, I give away to everyone who played rugby and everyone who's in agriculture. And wherever they were planted, including the tree nursery at the provincial government at Oliver, they grow phenomenally well. They grow very well, in fact. And within 3 to 5 years, they started bearing huge crops of cherries.
This is Terran Forma, greening these airwaves with happenings in environmental news for over 11 years.
So this is interesting. Why did he give them all away?
You know, I wondered that myself, and I did ask him what prompted him to do it freely rather than to turn a profit by giving these trees away, which were clearly very valuable. So here's what he had to say.
Well, I mean, I did eventually sell some of the cherry trees because some of the people had taken five off me and then selling them. So I thought, I'll sell them for $5 each or whatever, which is just nominal. But I just wanted people to grow them. In other words, I enjoyed living in Canada. I enjoyed Alberta in particular. And if I could do something for the local people and say, find them a cherry tree that did phenomenally well, so they'd be well off. What's better than cherry pie? Or what's better than cherry jubilee? I mean, they're even better than strawberries. Much better, in fact. More flavor. So anyway, I think I've achieved that now because most horticulturists are well aware of it. As the sort of fame of the tree got round, people gave away cuttings themselves and gave away root pieces. And the province of Quebec bought, I guess, 500,000 maybe. And they quickly spread to the US and across Canada, the colder parts, from Prince George through Prince Albert, all the way into Nova Scotia, where now everyone was growing these cold-tolerant, cold-hardy, massive crop-bearing Evans cherries.
And that last part there, I think, is really key. Edmonton is a very northerly city. We're, I think, the largest city of our size at this latitude in the whole world. We have a very short growing season. It's very cold until very late in the spring. Edmonton itself is designated as a Zone 3 garden zone, which is kind of a funny little pocket of warmer growing. It's very cold and a very short growing season. So what's quite interesting is that this cherry managed to thrive here based on these very harsh conditions.
And I guess now, across the prairies and into the U.S., there's probably 7 million, 8 million cherry trees, perhaps.
That's quite a legacy. So besides their cold tolerance, is there anything else that made this particular species of cherry so popular?
Yeah, there definitely is. I think one thing that Dr. Evans reiterated over and over in our conversation was just how prolific his cherries are. Here's Dr. Evans.
I took a tree back in the 90s, I think. It was about 8 to 9 foot tall and about 8 to 9 foot wide in my neighbor's garden. And the tree was measured from flowering through first fruit set to full fruit set. And from that tree, we took 450 pounds of cherries, which is phenomenal when you consider the fact that the average cherry tree in Wisconsin and Michigan produces a meager 50 pounds of sour cherries per tree.
Now, all of this to say, this one tree produces more than enough cherries for a single household. And that's how I learned about it in the first place. Remember, my friend who had all of these excess cherries and didn't really know what to do with them. And I ended up going over and picking enough cherries to make a pie. As a matter of fact, I've got a picture of the pie. I'll put it up on the website. You guys can all take a look and be jealous of the delicious baked goods that transpired.
Could have just brought us a slice.
Well, you're just going to have to wait, Andy. They're not ripe enough. I'll be back to that same tree. Don't you worry.
So if the Evans cherry has been naturally bred over centuries to have such a high yield, is it a leap to think that this could have some bearing on issues of like food security or sovereignty? Could Evans cherry's high yield be used to genetically engineer or modify other crops to have the same effect? I wonder, did you get a chance to ask him about any of these hot-button issues, like GMO?
As a matter of fact, yeah, I did. And I was particularly curious, since we don't often get people like of his experience here on Terra Informa. So I did ask him straight out, what do you think about GMOs?
In Southeast Asia, about 500,000 people suffer from blindness every year. Well, the GMO there was taking a gene from another plant species and inserting it into rice, a yellow gene that produced a yellow rice that was high in vitamin A. And yet there was huge opposition to this. Opposition. It took the Pope to bless the rice in order to get it going. And again, other examples of GMO was sort of cassava, which is a standby in Africa as far as carbohydrates concerned. The existing ones are susceptible to virus diseases. Well, they've come up with a gene from another species that they've inserted into this, and it's resistant, but they won't plant them. They'd rather let people starve than plant them. In my own country, in Wales, you try and grow potatoes, and my biologically or organically, you have no hope because of late blight. But they brought genes from another related plant to a potato. They put a potato GMO. I mean, you know, when you look at it and say, hey, you can now grow potatoes that are resistant to late blight, pesticide-free, what better? China grows 20 times more potatoes than North America, and India grows 10 times more potatoes than North America. And I mean, would they like blight-resistant potatoes? You bet. Would they worry about it? Never. But in the long run, what we're looking at is 9 billion people. How do we feed them?
So what did you take away from all this? I mean, you went on this adventure to find Dr. Evans, and you eventually did.
I sure did. And apart from the one little side lesson that I want to chuck everything and just move away and live on a farm, I think it's really important to acknowledge the potential that there exists in genetic engineering, the ability to modify certain fruits and vegetables to better withstand the impacts of things like climate change and, drought and other crop diseases. It's important to balance our concern and our valid suspicion of certain GMOs with an understanding that we need to be more efficient in how we produce food for the world. But, of course, that the sphere of control that industrial agriculture and food corporations yield is also really alarming. So if we want things like blight-resistant potatoes or golden rice, as Dr. Evans refers to in the interview, then we have to be more aware of the potential social justice that exists within the technology in genetic modification and engineering. Until we have a critical mass of people who are all invested in a sustainable food system in Canada, and internationally, of course, that there's very little stopping or companies like Monsanto and Dow from co-opting this technology and locking it away into proprietary technologies. It's something that really needs to be shared, that the humanitarian impact is just far too great for it to be controlled by very few and for profit.
So what we need here is greater balance.
Right, yeah. And the Evans cherry itself, we have to be clear here, was not actually engineered. It was found, fostered, and distributed freely with love and passion. So it's not that it's a difficult thing to grow, it just takes a little bit of care and the fertile ground of community supporting its proliferation.
In other words, we're all for progress, but we forget the fact that we need food to live, and we need quality food to live, and we need a range of foods to live, from vegetables and fruits right through to whatever else we chose to eat.
Well, thanks for sharing the fruits of your labor, Danielle.
Oh, you're welcome, Handy. Really, it was a grassroots effort, so I couldn't have done it without your help.
For Terra Informa, I'm Hamdi Sawi.
And I'm Danielle Dalgoy.
If you'd like to learn more about the Evans cherry, Ken Riske at Mill Creek Nursery loves to talk about that and other species he raises on his farm. We'll post links to other stories about the Evans cherry on our website, as well as photos of the Evans cherry to help you identify it if you or someone you know thinks they might have these bright red beauties growing in the backyard. If you've tried this northern delight and would love to share your tasting notes with us, tweet us at Terra Informa. And in the spirit of the North, sending a great big shout out to our listeners in Iqaluit, keeping it tuned to CKLB 101.9 FM. Before my sheepish co-host and I bid adieu, here's this week's edition of What's Happening. Wednesday night walks continue in Guelph, Ontario until the end of August. come out to the Arboretum this Wednesday night and learn to be a bat detective. Did you know bats are pollinators? And they're great for controlling pests, too. Learn all about these nocturnal creatures and how we can help them thrive in Ontario. The tour starts at 7 p.m., cost is $2, and kids under 5 are free. A reminder, too, about some of the events we mentioned last week. From August 21st to 24th, celebrate our little view of the universe at the Dark Sky Festival in Wood Buffalo National Park. Join in some night sky viewing with telescopes and binoculars in the world's largest dark sky preserve. There will also be festival meals, camping, and keynote presentations. In Bridgewater, Nova Scotia, the Growing Green Sustainability Festival will also take place from August 21st to 24th. It's a colorful introduction to the idea that we can work together to ensure that all human and non-human communities have a home on our planet. There will be a local dinner, a film festival by the river, and a bus tour of environmentally friendly businesses and organizations working in Lunenburg County. And in Edmonton, the John Walter Museum, down by the Kinsman Sports Center, is hosting a repair-a-thon and clothing swap. On Sunday, August 24th, bring your damaged clothes and have them repaired by volunteers. They'll do buttons, hems, rips, tears, and zippers if you bring your own. There is a 1-2 item limit per person, and they do ask that you only bring clean clothes and no undergarments, please. The event is free and takes place from 1 to 3 p.m. There is limited parking there, so they recommend that you do use transit. You can find links to all of these events on our website, terrainforma.ca. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks to our contributors, Danielle Dolgoy and Hamdi Asawi. Thanks to Trevor Chow-Fraser for taking care of website, Chris Changyan Phillips for production, and Hamdi Asawi for coordinating this week. Terra Informa is a production of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to send us an email to terra@cjsr.com. We've been your hosts, Yvette Thompson and Dash. Catch you next week.